It's unconscionable. Fix the law and get the benefits to these deserving Americans.
The Army cuts retirement benefits for members of Alaska's Territorial Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 22nd of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers consider economic relief for rural villages.
We want to know the true circumstances about what's going on before the legislature steps in and does something after an evaluation of how things are.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaskans who served in the Territorial Guard will no longer be able to count their service toward Army retirement benefits. The largely Native militia formed to protect the territory of Alaska from the threat of Japanese attack during World War II. 27 surviving members of the Guard currently qualify for monthly retirement benefits and health care from the Army. On the Senate floor this evening, Senator Lisa Murkowski demanded the Army reinstate the benefits and asked for an apology from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates.
What kind of a government? What kind of a Cruella could cut retirement benefits to a group of Eskimos in their 80s, in the dead of an Alaskan winter, and to say, sorry, there's nothing we can do. It's time for some soul-searching on this at the Pentagon. I'm looking for answers. I know you are looking for answers. We're looking for solutions, and there's really very little time left.
Murkowski says the Army is mailing letters to the Territorial Guard members, letting them know their benefits will be terminated next month. The action comes almost a decade after Congress passed a law qualifying time served in the unpaid Territorial Guard as active federal service. The Army agreed in 2004 to grant official military discharge certificates to members or their survivors. The elders who qualify for benefits are receiving from $200 to $1,000 per month. Lieutenant General Craig Campbell, State Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, calls the Army's action unacceptable. He says in this time of multi-billion dollar bailouts by the federal government, the decision can't possibly be based on an effort to trim costs.
And at a time when Native Alaskans in Western Alaska are having difficult time buying fuel and food, and we have a team right in Western Alaska right now looking at Emonik and Kotlik as to how we're going to provide them what they need for to sustain life in, out there in Western Alaska, and a lot of these Natives come from Western Alaska, it's unconscionable that the Department of Defense would cut off payments to 27 Native Alaskans.
General Campbell says the decision was based on the Army's perception that there is a legal problem with the constitutional act that granted the benefits. But he says if there is an issue with the law, it should be easy to correct, and he's optimistic President Barack Obama will agree.
They've already been approved for benefits by the Army. I can't believe that this president wouldn't tell the Army that's wrong. Fix the law and get the benefits to these deserving Americans.
Senator Murkowski says she and Senator Begich are preparing legislation that would clarify the law to make sure the benefits aren't terminated now or any time in the future. The Interior Department's new secretary, Ken Salazar, addressed his employees around the nation today from Washington and reiterated his pledge to clean up the department. The Interior Department has vast influence in Alaska, where it manages millions of acres of land and has trust responsibility for Alaska Natives. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
During Ken Salazar's confirmation hearing last week, he criticized past illegal activities and the general culture of the Interior Department under the Bush administration. But on Thursday, Salazar specifically pointed to high-level administrators as the ones with the ethical problems rather than career employees.
You know how one apple in a bushel can spoil the whole bushel? There has been essentially a picture of the department which has been painted unfairly on the backs of career employees, because of actions of political appointees, and that era is now changing, and it starts today.
Problems in recent years at the Interior Department range from accusations about politically motivated decisions to a sex and drug scandal involving employees who took gifts from the oil and gas industry. Salazar pledged that from now on, the Interior Department's decisions will be based on science and not special interests. He also promised to work with Native American tribes.
We need to do a lot more to address our Native American populations across this country that for too long they have been forgotten and left at the back end of the line. And it's time for us to address many of the issues that face Indian country.
Salazar said he has four main goals for the Bureau of Indian Affairs: to pursue economic development in Indian country, especially related to renewable energy projects, also improve health care and better educate children, and forge a relationship of respect and consultation with tribes. Salazar has said he took the post of Interior Secretary to help transform America's energy supply to renewable resources, but on Thursday he took a moderate stance, saying there's a place for fossil fuels too.
Our oil and gas and coal resources are very much a part of the equation of that future. Okay, we cannot get from here to there without, frankly, moving forward with the oil and gas resources that we have here in this nation, both on our lands as well as in some selected areas in the offshore area. And we cannot move forward simply by turning off the lights today and turning off all the coal-fired power plants.
Salazar was asked about last-minute midnight regulations by the Bush administration during its final months in power. They include changes to the Endangered Species Act and offshore oil drilling plans. Salazar wouldn't specify what he would like to see reversed.
Let me just say, there are good regulations, and there are maybe not such good regulations, and we haven't at this point had an opportunity to really sit down with people who were involved in crafting them and making decisions about how to move forward. So we will do that.
Ken Salazar was sworn in as the 50th Interior Secretary on Tuesday. The former senator from Colorado has now named some of his top staff members, including his chief of staff, Tom Strickland, who's a Colorado attorney. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich participated in his first high-profile confirmation hearing yesterday. As a member of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, he questioned President Barack Obama's nominee for Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. Begich asked LaHood about the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. He told LaHood that the projects first need about $2 billion in road and infrastructure projects in order to get materials to the sites. He asked if LaHood would work with the Alaska delegation on that.
We can't get the project moving without those reconstructions or new constructions to move the equipment, move the construction material. Is that something that you'd be willing to work with us on to get this mega project forward?
Yes, sir, and I don't know if you're in a position now that it's ready to go and could be a part of the stimulus, but that's if it is.
They are. They're all bid ready.
Well,
yeah. And we'll talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'll leave it at that. I'll take it. Because if I'm you're halfway there, so I don't want to blow it, so I'll take it.
I guarantee you won't blow it, Senator.
Okay, good. Well, they are bid ready.
And yeah, good.
Good jobs.
The stimulus package is now being discussed and hammered out in Washington. It's geared to fund projects that are shovel-ready and can be started immediately. Begich also voiced a concern that he has about the stimulus package, that much of its funding will go to states rather than to local governments.
It's going so much to the state bureaucracy that the amount that they take on the DOT on the state level, you'll knock 15, 20, maybe as much as 30% out of a project for just admin overhead, and then it will trickle down to the local governments who then have to deliver these projects. So I have some grave concerns over that.
Begich spoke at the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington on Monday and says many of the attendees agree with him that projects are more efficiently run at the local rather than the state level. Begich also participated in confirmation hearings last week as a member of the Armed Services Committee. They questioned leaders, including the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Yukon Quest secures a major sponsor, but is still looking for more.
This has been a challenging year, as everybody is aware, so we are doing our very best to make sure that as many of our sponsors can support us in any way they can.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Great weekdays begin with the most up-to-date local news and information on APRN's Alaska Morning News. The Alaska Morning News, the news you wake up to.
Nome Senator Donald Olson is hoping Governor Palin will address the urgent need for assistance in rural Alaska in her annual address to the legislature tonight. Olson, a Democrat from the small Seward Peninsula village of Golovin, says a recent trip to fill a 100-gallon fuel tank for his mother was troubling. He says another Golovin resident was there with a 5-gallon can, and the senator offered to let the man fill his can first.
And he said, no, I don't need to fill it. I can't afford to fill my 5-gallon jerry jug up. I can only put 3.7 gallons in here, and that's what I get every 2 weeks. And I just keep that to keep it so the kids stay warm at night. And so that was a real testimony to me that there are indeed significant things that are going on out there, and people are trying to cope as well as they can.
State officials were in Emonic and then Kotlik, and this afternoon they've been meeting with tribal and community leaders in Bethel. Emonic is part of Olson's Senate district. He says one idea that is a possibility for quick help is to replicate the program Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez provided in the past through CITGO.
That's one of the templates we've been looking at, is the possibility, especially there in Emonic, is to provide 100 gallons per household for the next couple of months to try and make sure we've got something there. But we're still assessing the situation. We want to know the true circumstances about what's going on before the legislature steps in and does something after an evaluation of how things are.
Olson says things don't move quickly through the legislature, and because of the urgency of the problems in bush communities, he says it's possible legislation could be introduced to offer some kind of relief as early as this weekend, but a lot depends on what the governor has to say.
We don't want to be stepping in front of the governor, who has immediate access to funds if she does meet the disaster criteria that are there. And we have to remember that there are statutes that dictate what kind of parameters need to be met before she can act, but the administrative branch does have the first response responsibilities with people in the departments.
Senator Olson says, whatever the approach, it needs to be soon.
We have to have something here shortly, because if even one person freezes to death, it's a real tragedy, and the state hasn't stepped up to it, what its responsibilities are. And so because of that, we're looking at trying to get the edge off it, because it's going to only get worse. We've got another cold snap that's going to be, you know, traditionally we have two or three cold snaps throughout the year. We've got 2 or 3 months to go.
Tara Jolly, the head of the state's Division of Community and Regional Affairs, is one of the state officials visiting the struggling communities. Jolly was still meeting with community members in Bethel this afternoon and did not return a phone call by airtime. Her staff said the turnout was much larger than expected. A new study shows that Alaska's fishing industry has a $5.8 billion impact on the state's economy. KUCB's Ann Hillman found out more.
The Marine Conservation Alliance recently commissioned a study from independent analysts Northern Economics on the economic impact of the state's fishing industry. The study used data from government agencies and research institutions rather than self-reported industry data to calculate the numbers. David Benton, the executive director of the Marine Conservation Alliance, wanted to provide accurate information to the public and to decision makers about the importance of fishing to the state and national economies.
In this instance, we wanted to have data that was very, reliable and that came from official sources, so that it really wasn't something that could be questioned.
The study found that the direct and induced economic output of the industry was $5.8 billion in 2007. That's more than the tourism or the mining sectors, and second only to oil and gas. Fishing directly creates more than 56,000 jobs for fishermen, processors, and others. Using a special formula, Northern Economics calculated that the fishing industry indirectly creates another 22,000 jobs as well. Altogether, that's more than the oil and gas and mining industries combined. The indirect jobs include service employees, like those at gas stations and grocery stores, and researchers.
And we also wanted to understand a little better the economic effect, if you would, of management and enforcement. So we asked for information to how much money roughly is being spent on scientific research in Alaska, enforcement of regulations by the Coast Guard, that kind of thing.
Benton says the management and enforcement jobs are important because they keep the resource sustainable. Alaska accounts for 62% of all wild-caught seafood landings in the United States, and the Bering Sea groundfish fishery is one of the largest in the world. Onalaska is the nation's second-largest port in terms of ex-vessel value. Kodiak is third. But Benton says people need to understand that the value of the fishery extends beyond ex-vessel value. He says this report shows the larger picture impact of the industry and its essential role in Alaska's economy. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Mark Myers is returning to Alaska to serve as the state's pipeline coordinator. Most recently, Myers has been headquartered in Washington, D.C. as director of the U.S. Geological Survey, and before that as the state's director of oil and gas. Myers says he's excited about the challenge of getting Alaska's gas to the lower 48.
You can see that in the nation, the need for this energy supply, and Alaska has such a huge potential to offer a significant portion of that supply of energy the country badly needs. So if you look at the new president and his goal to build an energy economy, Alaska Gas can play a huge role in that. So I'm really excited about the time to be able to come back and work on this project at a time when the country so badly needs the energy.
As director of the USGS, Myers directed 9,000 scientists studying energy, minerals, and climate change. He said it gave him a great opportunity to learn about the world's energy future. He says his job is to facilitate a project, but he says there are key elements in the contract the state has with TransCanada that are critical for the state and the country's future.
Clearly, the producer's gas needs to come into the line to be effective. So clearly, work with the companies, to work with the concerns, to work with both the companies that have proven reserves, but also the exploring companies, to work with the Canadian government, to work with a broad coalition, and in fact, even to work with environmental groups on their support of the project.
Meyer says the new job and the greatest challenge is to bring all the necessary interests and parties together to advance the project. He says he anticipates Alaska's gas being part of a long-term national energy plan. The Legislative Ethics Committee has found probable cause to a charge that Anchorage Senator Kevin Meyer used state resources to mail what could be construed as campaign material at state expense. The committee found that no corrective action is necessary. The complaint stems from a brochure jointly sent by Meyer and former Representative Ralph Samuels at the end of last year's legislative session. Normally, such mailings would also include information submitted by the senator for two adjoining districts. However, former Senator John Cowdery was hospitalized at the time and had not been present in Juneau for much of the session. Meyer says the rules were not clear governing such a mailing from a senator and both representatives, a very common practice.
I sent the newsletter to my people in House District 30, and Ralph sent it to House District 29. Where the complaint came was that one person who got it saw both of our pictures on it, complained that since I had already filed to run for the Senate seat, that I was getting an advantage by now having my picture, my name, and some of the accomplishments that we were able to get last session in front of House District 29. I don't know how we could have avoided that and still have done a joint newsletter.
Meyer says the limitations were nebulous, and he thinks the Ethics Committee will use the case to clarify policy on joint newsletters.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
Petersburg will move forward with permitting for a proposed hydroelectric project at Ruth Lake in Thomas Bay on the mainland north of town. The City Council voted unanimously to turn in a preliminary permit application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But some residents who favor the public project also worry it could bolster controversial plans for private hydro development at other mountain lakes in the bay. From member station KFSK, Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The city's preliminary proposal includes the construction of a 100 to 200-foot dam and lake tap to harness up to 20 megawatts of energy from the small body of water. That's comparable to the maximum capacity of the Tai Lake plant, which currently powers Wrangell and Petersburg. According to Petersburg Electric Superintendent Joe Nelson, a second major source of hydropower at Ruth Lake would eliminate the need for the city's backup diesel generators and help meet future electric needs.
So you got the two things coming together here. You've got down the road, eventually the two communities, especially with electric heat going in the way it is, Tai is going to be fully utilized by approximately, this is just a projection, 2015.
Thomas Bay is a very important local spot for fishing, hunting, and recreation. That's one of the key reasons why many Petersburg area residents and the city council have formally opposed Cascade Creek LLC's plans for the bay. The Bellingham Washington Company proposed the construction of a series of hydro facilities at three mountaintop lakes in Thomas Bay, including Swan Lake, Scenery Lake, and Ruth Lake. The company wants to sell power to Canada and the lower 48 via a proposed transborder power line. Petersburg officials emphasize that the city's Ruth Lake proposal would have a much smaller footprint on the environment and would solely benefit the public's interest rather than the interests of a private corporation. City Manager Richard Underkoffler explained why the city council decided to pursue its own project at Ruth Lake when there was such an outcry against the private company's plan in Petersburg.
When the city council heard that reaction, they said, well, Ruth Lake on its own would be a much more environmentally responsible project. It's smaller. It wouldn't have the impacts that the other two projects would. And it could be sized for what our needs would be for as an alternative to diesel generation.
The city's proposal prompted several comments of support. However, some of that support was tempered by concern. Some residents, like Martha Smith, worried that Petersburg's plan could serve as precedent or encouragement for Cascade Creek LLC's plans.
I support Petersburg's development of Ruth Lake. I do not support Cascade Creek's development of the other two sites. And I think if we're going to develop this project, we should at least have a discussion about how people feel about that. That it shouldn't be taken as a tacit agreement to Cascade Creek proceeding with the other two hydro projects.
Petersburg's next step is to file its preliminary permit application with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. If the community gets the permit, it will have the exclusive right to study the hydroelectric potential of Ruth Lake for 3 years. Cascade Creek LLC currently holds the preliminary permit for Ruth Lake, but it expires in February. The city will likely be competing for the new permit with the company, as well as with the borough of Wrangell. Unlike Petersburg, the Wrangell Borough Assembly has agreed to work with Cascade Creek and recently decided to file for the Ruth Lake permit as well. There's a municipal preference for the permit, so the involvement of a friendly municipality like Wrangell is helpful for the company. Several people, like retired Fire Marshal Doug Weldy, stressed the importance of planning for Petersburg's future as they spoke in favor of the city's proposal for Ruth Lake. Weldy pointed to the long-term value of the small 2-megawatt plant at nearby Crystal Lake, south of Petersburg. The plants helped provide cheap hydroelectric power to the town since the 1920s.
People spent the money, put the program in. It was a big debt, but we're in good shape now. I think we need to look ahead and do the same thing for our children and our grandchildren.
When it came down to a council decision later Monday night, there was not much more discussion. The vote was unanimous in favor of submitting the federal permit application. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Beginning February 1st, the Coast Guard and other search and rescue personnel will only monitor and receive distress alert broadcasts using digital 406 megahertz emergency position indicating radio beacons, or EPIRBs. KMXT's Eric Wander has more.
The Coast Guard will no longer monitor 121.5 or 243 megahertz emergency beacons as of the first of next month. In addition, search and rescue satellites will no longer process older model analog EPIRBs that only transmit on 121.5 or 243 megahertz. Robert Davis is a marine science technician at the Coast Guard's Marine Safety Detachment in Kodiak.
On February 1st, the satellite that picks up the 121 signal for the Class A, B, and S maritime EPIRB stations, the 121.5, is basically being discontinued and will no longer pick up the satellite signal.
In anticipation of the change, the digital 406 megahertz became the only frequency approved for use in both commercial and recreational watercraft worldwide on January 1, 2007. Satellite processing from all 121.5 or 243 megahertz EPIRBs will be terminated on February 1st of this year.
Basically, we just don't want anybody with a 121 EPIRB to think that if it goes off that somebody is going to be there to rescue them.
Petty Officer Sarah Francis of the Coast Guard in Anchorage said the new regulations are designed in part to reduce possible false alarms, something that was common with the 121.5 and 243 megahertz frequencies.
Only one out of about every 50 EPIRB hits from the 121.5 and 243s was an actual distress. We seem to have a lot more false positives with that design.
Ted Rogers, owner of Joycraft's marine safety equipment, said he saw sales of the 406 megahertz EPIRBs begin to increase long before the new regulations were announced.
We have a pretty savvy group here in Kodiak.
EPIRB owners are required by law to provide emergency contact information and a vessel description by registering their beacon with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. This allows search and rescue personnel to quickly confirm if a distress signal is real and identify what type of boat or aircraft to look for in the event of an emergency. I'm Eric Wander.
The Yukon Quest is working its way back toward a full purse for next month's race. Yesterday, organizers announced a new sponsor means at least $150,000 can be guaranteed for payout to mushers. The biggest boost in race support comes from TransCanada. Quest Yukon Territory Director Stephen Reynolds says the pipeline company is moving beyond the level of support it's put toward the race since coming on board in 2007.
They've been at the lead dog level, which is a minimum investment of $5,000. And for the 2009 race, we're very, very pleased to announce that they have stepped up to our major sponsor level, which is a minimum commitment of $25,000. So it's a significant additional investment for them.
The exact amount of money TransCanada is providing is being kept confidential. The added money comes after race finances have absorbed some hits, including loss of longtime major sponsor Sorrel this past fall. Reynolds says TransCanada is currently the Quest's only major sponsor.
But we're working on a couple more, hopefully that we'll agree to step up to that level over the next week or so. This has been a challenging year, as everybody is aware, both economically as individuals and corporations. So we are doing our very best to make sure that as many of our sponsors can support us in any way they can.
Reynolds says that includes services and supplies necessary for the 1,000-mile race, which he says costs more than $1 million to put on. 35 teams are currently signed up for the Quest, which starts February 14th in Whitehorse. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Eric Wander in Kodiak, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.